You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 6th of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, we answer one of the toughest questions of the year. What to pack for your holiday reading? The arts desk Jasper Rees will be on hand to offer help. Plus,
I threw your shit into a bag and pushed it down the stairs.
We'll talk through the best new music with a woman who knows, Mercury panel judge Jude Rogers. And
she is very kind. She's beautiful. She's good. We're not ingrates. Every night in our attic, we kneel and pray for her, just like we've been taught.
We head to Sydney for a slice of the city's best new theatre.
Cate Blanchett giving me goosebumps there. Plus, we'll talk you through a great weekend in Bilbao. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Welcome to Studio One here at Midori House, where here in London we have plunged headlong into summer, haven't we, Gillian?
Oh, it's divine. Finally, summer has come, and with summer comes the summer season. And I have to say, my extracurricular activities have been all revolved around Wimbledon this week.
Absolutely. Things have totally changed in my house. We have we have now embraced the season. The kitchen has become a hive of cookery books and sort of the revival of the ricotta and spinach recipes. It's all gone terribly, terribly Italian summer.
How wonderful. And of course, I want to come to your house,
absolutely,
Emma.
Absolutely. And it is paired entirely with the slightly counterintuitive practice of gluing ourselves to the television this week. Our cultural life this week has been revolved around the box. Glastonbury, Wimbledon, of course, unfortunately following all the events in Egypt as well. So as soon as the sun comes out, we have retreated indoors.
But the wonderful thing is everyone has their windows open. So you walk out of the office just to get a coffee or your newspaper and you hear the roars and cheers of Wimbledon as Murray scores a point, and you hear Glastonbury on the television. So you're hearing it even on the streets.
It's wonderful in the way that Wimbledon has offered us some jewels this year. Yesterday, I think I didn't care that it was 26 and sunny outside. The match between Djokovic and Del Potro was just brilliant. You watch it with a smile on your face.
But it's, you know, whether it's the elasticated legs of Djokovic or, you know, the quick speed of Del Potro, it was magic, absolute magic.
You were there this week, weren't you? Wimbledon is an entire lifestyle that you have to buy into for 24 hours. What was it? What
if
were you doing?
If you're lucky enough. Well, no, it was great because you do invest the whole day. And it's the experience of you smell the grass. You literally walk on the courts in the morning and you smell the grass. And then you hear the pop of the tennis players practicing on court. And so I heard some pops and I thought, nothing started yet. Someone's practicing. I'll just have a look. And it was Serena Williams just warming up with her warm-up partner. And I sat there for 20 minutes, 10, 15 feet away from Serena Williams warming up. But then the day unravels and you have your Pims and you have your strawberry and cream and you pop out onto the courts. It's total summer ritual.
It's an astonishing thing, the way that it moves so quickly as well. Not just the fact that the tennis players move quite sharply.
I move quite slowly.
But the fact that before you know it, it's gone in a flash. And it is something that the whole of the United Kingdom at least builds up to for an entire year. And then it just goes. 2 weeks vanish.
Which is why it makes it so special.
It is. It's incredibly special. Oh, well, in a few moments' time, we're going to be talking books. We'll be looking at what we should be doing for our essential summer reading. I'm always one that brings out the recipe books. I take the recipe books on holiday with me. I go to wherever I go in the world, I will take a recipe book from that area and cook accordingly. So I shall be digging out the Italian again, that spinach and ricotta. We're going to get so bored by the end of July. Do you know what your summer reading books are going to be yet?
Well, I was going through my bookshelf because usually it's the time that I read anything I haven't read. But I was driving to work and I heard Ian McEwan talking about this incredible book called Stoned, which was actually written, I think 20, 25 years ago. And it's by an author called John Williams. Didn't really do very well. Suddenly it is having a life of its own. And hearing Ian McEwan talk about it, reading excerpts of the book. So after the show, I'm going down to our local bookshop, Daunce, and I'm going to buy myself a copy.
Daunce, brace yourself. Gillian DeBias is on the way.
With a mission.
Armed with a credit card. It's at 8 minutes past the hour. You're with The Review. To begin the show today, we're getting out of the studio and heading down under to hear about two productions which have caught the attention of Sydney's critics.
Verdi's Force of Destiny is a dark tale of undying love, bitter vengeance and elaborate disguises. And it's on stage at Sydney's Opera House. It's young director Tamara Matheson's first main stage opera debut, and it opened to glittering reviews.
But the production's international cast is not the only foreign stars currently performing in Sydney. France's screen queen Isabelle Huppert is playing to sell out audiences in Sydney theatre company's The Maids, and it's also starring Cate Blanchett. The pair deliver knockout performances, but some critics have questioned whether one stage is big enough for the both of them. Claire Aird spoke to the independent critic Ben Neutzer.
It's a postcard perfect day at Sydney's Opera House. Tourists mill about in the sunshine and ferries cruise past into Circular Quay. But inside the iconic house, a giant human skull sits ominously above the space where Verdi's classic opera of Vendetta, Elopement, Love, Vengeance and Doom will play out when night falls. Ben Neutzer is an independent theatre critic and he joins me to discuss the work. Ben, this is set in 19th century Europe. That's the period that it was written in. This is almost unheard of in Australian theatre at the moment. What did you think?
Yeah, I think it's true that a lot of our directors at the moment are really in love with, you know, taking your work and making it their own. There's this massive debate happening about auteur directors even, and that director-led theatre. And in some senses, Force of Destiny, you know, it's quite a traditional production, but in others it takes these steps forward and goes somewhere where you're not quite anticipating it to go. But I think what they've done particularly well is they haven't really updated it, but they've made it really speak to its audience. Tamara Matheson has decided to embrace that darkness, the gloominess. One of the more interesting things that they've done with this is they've taken the role of the gypsy. She's played by Rinat Shaham in this, who Sydney audiences will remember as Carmen from Opera on the Harbour. And they've taken that character, who traditionally has quite a small role, and they've turned her into this kind of, I suppose you could say, a mistress of death. And she's there to drive certain elements physically, and she's always lurking in the shadows. And Renat does that very, very well.
Now, there are a lot of shadows in this piece, and it's lit by candlelight. What did you think of the set design?
I think the set in some ways is quite sparse. It's really monolithic. There's that giant skull. There's also a giant Virgin Mary, which as it comes forward on the stage, you think, is that going to collide with something up above in the fly space? So they're all big, bold statements, which actually is quite a contrast with what Mark Thompson has done with the costumes, which are all beautifully detailed and ornate.
This production stars overseas principals Svetla Vasileva and Ricardo Massi. What did you think about their performances?
I think Svetla is delivering one of the most exciting performances that we've seen on the operatic stage this season. What makes it so great is that she is such a fine dramatic actress. And it's not just in her physicality, it's in her vocal storytelling. What she really does, which is impressive, is she uses the acoustics of the Joan Sutherland Theatre and the Opera House, which, you know, are not really ideal, but she uses them so beautifully in these tender moments where she manages to just whisper a note out and it soars over the whole theatre. So it's a very impressive performance. Ricardo Massi is also very strong, but I have to say, when he's on stage with Svetla, you know, your eyes are immediately drawn to her because just such a quality performance.
This opera is fairly long at 4 hours. Did it feel this long to you?
Look, honestly, there are some moments where it does. But, I mean, the production is very engaging, and if you're a Verdi fan, you know, you're going to love it because it's a really truthful, gutsy version of the work.
She is very kind. She's beautiful. She's good. We're not ingrates. Every night in our attic, we kneel and pray for her just like we've been taught. We never speak out of turn. We're always very professional. and it's killing us.
Now, around from the Opera House and around from Circular Quay, on the water as well, is the Sydney Theatre Company. Another massive production is taking place there currently, The Maids. Ben, how does an Australian audience empathise with a 1947 French play about domestic servitude?
Look, obviously, I think that's probably one of the most difficult challenges that Benedict Andrews and Andrew Upton had when they were adapting this work. You know, we don't have maids here who their entire lives are completely tied to their employers. But I think they didn't exactly shy away from that, but they found a way of making that speak to today's audience by making all the elements surrounding that domestic servitude really contemporary. Although I do know that some people found it quite difficult to connect with the work for that very reason.
Director Benedict Andrews has made some rather bold theatrical statements with his choice of set. What did you think about the glass box, the video projections? How did you think that worked?
Obviously, the glass box and the video projections, for anybody who's seen a Benedict Andrews show, you know, they're some of his trademarks. I think in this piece, they were justified. And the glass box in particular worked really well because in The Maids, the main characters have this feeling that they're constantly being watched. And there's also a thematic thing going on throughout the whole thing about the nature of acting and the nature of playing a role, obviously, which comes through with The Maid's role play. And I think putting them in this glass box, it makes it almost like we're observing them, which is also highlighted with the use of the video cameras. The video cameras basically film from either side of the stage, a lot of the action in close-up, and that's broadcast live on a screen above the stage. I almost think it's like when you go to a rock concert and, you know, how you get that feeling. But like in a rock concert, one of the problems is I actually, even though I was sitting in about the seventh row, I found myself watching the screen above them when I really wanted to just be watching the stage. But I think, you know, you've got Cate Blanchett, Isabelle Huppert, and Elizabeth Debicki, who are all, you know, fantastic screen actresses. They have faces that the camera just loves. Why wouldn't you film them?
Cate Blanchett and Isabelle Huppert are massive stars, and both their performances were huge. Do you think that the chemistry is right? Do you think they blended well? Or is the stage crowded, in a sense, by these two massive characters?
When I walked out, one of the first things that I thought was, I feel like I'm watching two actresses working in two different plays, which is a shame because I actually wanted to see both of those plays, but probably not at the same time. I found Cate was giving a really earthy, very raw performance, whereas Isabelle was... It was a slightly more traditional approach, and that's not a criticism, and I'm not saying that she wasn't gutsy with what she was doing, because anybody who's seen it will say it's a very gutsy performance. It's a very challenging work, and it's the type of play that you'll find yourself mulling over for, you know, a good week afterwards. There's so much in it, and watching it is such an intellectual exercise. There's so much symbolism, fantastic performances. And I think if you're the type of person who prefers their theatre to be more of an intellectual exercise than an emotional one, you'll enjoy this, because a lot of people have found it difficult to connect with, but I don't think anybody could deny how intellectually fulfilling it is.
That was Ben Neutzer there talking to Claire Aird. The Forza del Destino, Forts of Destiny, is playing at the Sydney Opera House until the 23rd of July. The Maids is on at Sydney Theatre until the 20th. You're listening to The Review.
And welcome back to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian DeBias, and Emma Nelson.
Time now to turn to our weekly music review. This week, we're delighted to say we're joined by the music journalist and radio presenter Jude Rogers. Jude has written for, well, pretty much everybody, really, every music publication going at least. She's also sat on the judging panel of the influential Mercury Prize since 2007. She joins us today with a collection of her music choices for the weeks ahead. Jude, welcome to The Review.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for coming in on a glorious Saturday afternoon here in London. We said that you write for absolutely everybody. Who do you write for and what do you write about?
Okay, I write about music, films, books. I interview the great and good of the arts and culture and other things. I write for The Guardian, Observer. I write for lots of women's magazines, Red, Marie Claire, Elle.
And when it comes to music, like, what's your specialty? What do you focus on?
I'm one of these all-rounders, which is what you're supposed to say, obviously, if you're a freelance journalist who writes for everybody. I love music from the cheesiest pop music to traditional folk music to disco and electronic music to classical.
Is there anything that you absolutely hate?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably not, actually. I'll give anything a go. Yeah, I've been getting into really hard rock from the early 70s recently, which I never thought I would. I always thought I'd hate.
I'm but sure just, your neighbours wish you hadn't.
Yeah, Black Sabbath going through the wall is not a good thing.
Well, I think you and the rest of the world actually have revisited Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
It's an astonishing thing that's happened to music in the last few months that basically everything from the last 20 years has come back and bitten us all on the backside.
Yeah, and Black Sabbath getting to number one. I know they've got a strong fan base, but I never thought that would happen. But it did. So well done to them, yeah.
Just looking at the way that you choose your music, obviously this influences the way you judge on the Mercury Prize. Tell us a little bit more about the process behind that and what it's like being the subject of a prize that lots of people say is actually almost a kiss of death in many ways. How do you stop that from happening?
Yes, well, kind of, this is the first year, because I did 6 years in a row and I'm finally off the panel, so I can say everything now. people usually do 3 or 4 years and I did 6, which is quite exciting. It's very hard. You have to listen to over 200 records. Everything they sent in, you have to listen to them. So that involves a lot of wandering around with your iPod on. You should get this very, very lovely iPod listening to all this stuff. And, you know, having to be quite brutal sometimes. And also try not to be too keen on the ones you've always loved and give everything a chance. It's quite difficult.
And what about with the other judges? Is it like a Cannes Film Festival where you have the head of a jury and then you battle it out?
Yeah, we have a chair. Yeah, we have a chair, Simon Frith, who's been there since day one of the prize. So he's seen all the criticism. I've had some interesting years. I've had some years where it's been very genteel and we've agreed quite easily. I've had some years where, the first year I nearly threw a bread roll at Lauren Laverne. I did, because when the Claxons won, who were not my choice, Amy Winehouse is Back to Black, didn't win the Mercury Prize. I'm still not mad about that at all. I am. But it's quite interesting. You have two rounds. You have a kind of long list meeting and a short list meeting. And you battle it out. It's going to be really interesting this year, seeing how it happens as an outsider. I'll probably be the cynical person saying, you know,
still
it's terrible.
Throwing bread rolls at the television.
Yes, indeed.
I always wonder how you actually listen to an album to judge it for a prize. Because when you have, let's say you're a literary judge, you sit down and you concentrate on that book until it is finished. With an album, though, as is the way you listen to it anyway, you start off by concentrating and then occasionally, unless there's an absolute standout track, I don't know about you, but my mind tends to wander or I can find myself doing something else. Do you have to sort of lock yourself away in a room and listen as an active process?
I do think that that's a flaw in the process, that you can't, even though you have quite a few months to listen to all these records, listen to the stuff with as much concentration as you'd want to. You've got to be brutal. I try and concentrate as much as I can. But then again, if you do, your mind does start to wander. That sort of tells you something about a record.
Yeah, exactly.
You also have a kind of, you know, you're trying to find a record that really, some 12 records that sum up, you know, kind of the year and you know, where music is, you know, how good it is, you know, the kind of positives about that year. Picking the 12 records is great. Picking the one is really difficult.
Absolutely.
And every year there's different debates about, you know, what it should be, what it means.
Have you ever kicked yourself for making the wrong decision?
No, I haven't. There have been some there, you know, sometimes the record I wanted to win didn't win, like last year. Sorry, LJ, but it wasn't my choice. But there have been some years that the prize has been criticised. Speech to Bell won in 2009 and everybody thought that was a terrible decision. That's a great record. Listen to it. It's a great record. Great for a sunny day, as it is here in London.
Well, talking about sunny days, you've brought some music in for us today.
Yes.
So how would you describe your curation, your collection of music
today? Well, I thought I'd bring in some stuff for the summer. I know this is very London-based at the moment because we're having this glorious weather. I thought I'd pick three tracks that sum up the kind of, you know, excitement of summer, kind of a real joy and energy to them. And I picked a track for, you know, when you've had a bit more, too much sun and you just want to have a little bit of lie down on your sofa or your hammock.
So what's your first track?
So my first track is by the Petra Boys, who I love and have always loved. Saw them a couple of weeks ago at the O2 in London, where Chris Lowe, the silent keyboardist, was wearing a glitter ball as a hat behind his keyboard. Anybody does that instantly. I love that band. This is a track off their new album.
Tell us a bit more about it, because they've always specialised in daft costumes. Yeah. There's a wonderful interview somewhere where Neil Tennant takes some journalists downstairs to basically the storeroom.
Yes.
Where they keep all their old props and all their old stuff. And do you remember the cone, the big cones that they all wore on their head? There's a wonderful line where Neil Tennant picks it up and just goes, it's really bad quality, isn't it? It's really rubbish, this stuff.
That's a great piece.
And it's a fabulous exploration of a sort of an artistic journey of two very, very creative men. And they're still managing to pull it off, I hate to say it, at their age. We'll mention the Rolling Stones, who are just age is a completely different sphere for those two, for that lot. But the Pet Shop Boys resurgence is really quite startling, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, they've been going as a band since the early 80s. They've been successful since the mid 80s. Neil Tennant's 59. Chris Lowe is a 53 old man wearing a glitter ball on his head on stage. All the lasers in that gig were coming off his glitter ball. That was lighting the whole of the O2. It was quite a sight. You know, their music, I've always loved it because it is so accessible at the time, so instant and immediate. But, you know, peel away the layers and it's so clever and intellectual and so many references layered in, like this song. This is called Love is a Bourgeois Construct, which my husband thinks is a parody of a Pet Shop Boys song title. We were arguing about this morning. I love this song. It has all the kind of pop the low art and high art that Pet Shop Boys always has. It has a pumping sort of dance beat. It has a sample from Chasing Sheep by Michael Nyman, of course, which is turned into this kind of sort of rave backing beat. The title is inspired by a line from a David Lodge novel. And it's a song about laziness and falling out of love and being in love. It's fantastic.
Let's have a listen. Somewhere on the Gold Hawk Road, I don't think it's gonna be much longer till I'm mugging up on the penal code. Love is a bourgeois construct, so I've given up on the bourgeoisie. Like all their aspirations, it's a fantasy. When you walked out, you did me a favour. You made me see reality. That love is a bourgeois construct. It's a blatant fallacy. You won't see me with a bunch of roses, promising fidelity. A perfect piece of pop from the Pet Shop Boys. Their Love is a Bourgeois Construct. Jude, you chose that because it was this perfect mix of lowbrow and highbrow. And just listening to that, you do that get these lovely startling moments as you get a great line from Neil Tennant about hanging out with Riff Raff on the Gold Hawk Road.
Exactly.
And then Michael Nyman comes in and everyone goes,
Is that the Draftsman contract?
Yeah. It's a brilliant, imaginative piece of music.
Yes, and I think that's why they're still, you know, reviewed a lot. That's still why they're kind of held quite high in kind of people's esteem, kind of critics and elsewhere. You know, the last couple of albums have been good records too. The last one, but half of it was great and half of it was a bit more melancholy. But, you know, they have this combination of melancholy and joy and all their stuff. What I think is really important to them keeping relevant is the people they work with. For this album, they work with the producer, Stuart Price, who is a fantastic pop producer, worked with Madonna and Confessions on the Dance Floor, which was her best album for years, and I don't think her albums since have been as good. you know, they have a song on this record with Example, the rapper and singer, and, you know, they're trying to stay contemporary, but they have that sense of humour about themselves, so it's never particularly po-faced. I like that about them a lot.
It's interesting you say they're trying to stay contemporary, and it's good that they're also branching out. They're not just, you know, trying to do a comeback of what they were, but they're working on ballet scores and film scores, so they're really kind of evolving and branching out.
Oh, completely. The last 10 years, they've done so many things, the ballet score you're talking about. I saw them doing a soundtrack to Battleship Potemkin on Trafalgar Square. You know, that's what's great about them. That's why I loved them when I was a child. You know, I first heard who Che Guevara and Debussy were because they were mentioned in a Pet Shop Boys song. You learn stuff from them while you're grinning and dancing around, and that's what the best pop music is to me.
But if you want to take it as a daft pop song, then you can enjoy it as well.
Exactly. You can just, bop
it's
around.
Good fun. And one always gets the impression that they're laughing their heads off when they're doing it.
Yeah.
Which is always a very key point of music. Let's move on to another of your choices. Current number one, I Love It.
Yeah, I thought I'd bring this up because there's a really interesting story about this. Now, this is a song you've probably heard somewhere around the world because it's been number one in so many countries. It was first released in May 2012 in Sweden, where Icona Pop from. Icona Pop are two young women who are DJs and producers, Caroline, apologies for pronunciation, Hjelt and Aino Jawo. I'm sorry if those. I did try to check it out this morning, pronunciation. Hopefully, those are right. They've done various kind of things, but this is so ridiculously catchy and in your face. It's been on every show. It's been on Girls in America. It's been on, you know, you turn on any TV station around the world, this will be synced behind something. It's just this perfect summer pop song. It's, you know, two girls having fun, kind of. You know, and I think it's a very young, youthful song, which, you know, obviously when it's summertime, you kind of remember past summers and all this kind of stuff. There is a lyric about, telling people off who have kind of 70s tastes because they are 90s bitches, which makes me feel old because that was when I was young. But it just got this joie de vivre about it, which I just adore. And it's amazing that it's taken so long to get number one in this country, but it's number one now.
Here we go. Let's have a listen. Icona Pop with a little bit of help from Charlie XCX there. I love it. Long loved on the Monocle 24 playlist as well because we're a big fan of Scandi Pop, as you couldn't tell already. that was obviously the song, The Sound of the Summer. One track that has been the sound of the spring to the summer is Daft Punk with a little bit of help from Chic. And last week at Glastonbury, I think it was universally accepted that Chic were the best act by a country mile. I mean, please do disagree if you like. I wasn't there. I was the armchair Glastonbury
I was
girl.
Also the armchair, yes.
Every year I vow to go, then every year I cannot be bothered to upload my photograph. And then that's it. I just get a weekend of regret in my kitchen listening to the radio going, I really should go. I really should go one more time, just get it out of my system, have done with it. And this, the performance by Chic was the performance that made me smack myself on the forehead and say, stupid. You've chosen a track from Chic to bring in. Why have you brought it in, Jude?
Well, I brought it in because, you know, Nile Rodgers is the man of the moment, amazingly, given that he's been making music since the 60s.
And he's nearly died about three times.
You know, his life story, if you don't know, is just incredible. You know, born to heroin addicts. He was in bands in, playing in bands in the 70s, you know, and become this incredible session musician at the Apollo in Harlem. And then suddenly he sort of falls in love with Roxy Music and thinks, I want to have a band that are sort of like the black version of Roxy Music and invent Chic. And, you know, the two, you know, it's funny looking at Daft Punk now because, you know, their album is doing so on Get Lucky is obviously everywhere. And so much of Daft Punk's aesthetic is from Chic. You know, they've, the anonymity, I'm so excited and my words are running away. You know, could have Daft Punk get that from Chic because they didn't really present themselves in that same way. And the beats and the rhythms, just fantastic. I saw Chic last year at Lovebox in London. The great thing about Chic, you can see them anywhere. They're playing around the world. They're on a constant tour.
They seem very jobbing.
Yes.
If you look them up, I think they're in Birmingham, in the Midlands, in the United
Go
Kingdom
see
this
them
week.
If you're in Birmingham.
And then next week they're somewhere else, completely obscure. They don't seem to have... there's no snobbery about it.
No, and I also think Nile Rodgers just wants... You know, because he came so close to death a couple of years ago with cancer, you read his blog, actually, and he is saying... I've just realised that I have to do all this now. And you look
and
at the list of songs
performing.
That he's made. He wrote, you know, Like a Virgin. He wrote kind of We Are Family, not as well as the Chic songs. This is from a compilation that has just come out called Up All Night. It is fantastic. This is a kind of lesser known song called Spacer, which is by Sheila B. and Devotion, written by Nile Rodgers and the Chic team. And it is one of the lost ones, but it is one of my favourite songs written by Nile Rodgers. And I just thought I'd bring this in to... let people know about it.
From Up All Night, Greatest Hits by Chic. That track was called Spacer. It is the choice of Jude Rodgers, the journalist, Mercury Music Prize judge, musical factotum, I think one could argue.
Oh, I'm having that.
What I love about listening to when I hear Chic is it always makes me about 6 inches taller,
yeah,
2 stone thinner, and a good dancer. There is something absolutely ebullient about Chic.
Yeah.
And you can see it when you see Nile Rodgers on stage. He seems genuinely delighted that anyone's letting him play an instrument of any kind nowadays, let alone headline at Glastonbury. How important do you think that is nowadays to inject more fun back into music? You know, we saw it with the Pet Shop Boys a little while ago. Things seem to be taking a slightly smiley turn at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's a theory that, when Chic had the big hit with Good Times, that was written in the late 70s, which was a very difficult time economically in America and across the world. And it was written using a phrase from the 20s when 20s and 30s when the Depression was on. And obviously in times, it sounds like a cliche, but it does seem to hold up in times when, you know, people are struggling in different ways, then pop stars, you know, they kind of try and bring the fun back. You know, that Daft Punk album is incredibly, you know, fun and lively and has so much ambition within it. I also get the sense that people just want to make these exciting records because the music industry has been going through a difficult time. And, you know, this year has been the best year for music for a long time, I think. And it's great that you have the heart of it, somebody like Nile Rodgers, and his career has been praised. It's great.
Jude Rodgers, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on The Review and for bringing in such cheerful music.
We cross now to our Toronto Bureau Chief, Nelly Gocheva, who's here to talk us through some cultural highlights for the coming days from around the world.
This weekend, Seattle Art Museum celebrates 30 years of Japanese fashion with its new exhibition entitled Future Beauty. On show are 80 dresses ranging from classic to avant-garde designs by the likes of Rei Kawakubo and Yoji Yamamoto. As expected, on display are also plenty of art photos and videos of fashion shows. Future Beauty is at Seattle Art Museum until the 8th of September. If in London, visit the Summer Yalom Gallery in Mayfair, where Korean artist Yan Kyun-shang has her first solo exhibition. Eastern traditions and modern architectural shapes interact in the artist's peaceful paintings. On display at the gallery until the 2nd of August. If in New York, head off to Brooklyn Museum to check out the Ode to Joy exhibition presented by Bruce High Quality Foundation. Ode to Joy is a submersive yet humorous retrospective of over 50 pieces of installation art, live performances, and films by local artists. if you prefer to see an independent film this weekend, we suggest Paradise Faith. This is the second installment of the Paradise trilogy by Austrian director Uri Seidel. Faith follows the life of Anna Maria, a Viennese X-ray technician in the morbid urban surroundings. Paradise Faith won the special jury prize at Venice Film Festival last year and is now out at cinemas across the UK. Finally, this weekend, we are going to Amsterdam's Pitch Festival, where highlights include sets from left-field hip-hopper Daedalus and the infectious indie pop of Churches. But now let's hear a new one from Brit folk pop collective Tongue, who are playing on Saturday. It is Embers by Tongue. Monocle from Toronto, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
Wrap those tiny heads, round those tiny fallen heads, glowing, picturesque, clothes with faces picturesque, flung, flung fears, grinding, flung, grinding all the gears, slick head, lift your chin, slipper air, shiver and grin.
And that was Embers by Tongue, ending that report by Nelly Gotcheva.
It's Saturday, so you must be listening to the review on Monocle 24. We cross now to Bill Bauer to hear what's coming up there in the next few days. Monocle's Paul Noble jetted off for the weekend, and he sent us this report to whet your cultural appetite.
Hello from Bill Bauer and things to do over the weekend. The legendary jazz alto saxophonist Lou Donaldson is dropping by Bill Bauer on Saturday, July the 6th. If you like your blues moody and your bop hard, head to Café Anzuka. Lou Donaldson made his name on the Blue Note label, playing with all the biggest artists from the golden age of jazz, including Art Blakey, Donald Byrd and Thelonious Monk. That's Saturday the 6th at Café Anzuka. Bringing things up to date, for those with a taste for the experimental, the Zarata Festival looks at the outer boundaries of music and noise, with Spanish artists playing everything from dubstep to turntablism, psych rock to post-punk, and intriguingly, a band called I Treni Inerti playing what they describe in their own words as minimal accordion plus trumpet. That's the 8th edition of Zarata Fest, July the 5th and 6th, in Club Larasquito in Bilbao. And a little further east, in Pamplona, the event that has put this small town on any good cultural calendar, the San Fermín Festival, or the Running of the Bulls as it's better known, the choice of mavericks, exhibitionists, and lunatics everywhere. This sees the narrow and crowded streets of Pamplona filled with man and beast, not quite in harmony, as a herd of angry cattle are let loose for a sprint through this historic Basque town. Expect broken bones and tales of heroism. And finally, a touch of drama. As part of the Bilboko Calieda Festival, the squares and streets of the Ensanche and the historic centre of Bilbao turn into a stage during the first week of July and host the very latest theatre, circus, dance, aerial acrobatics, street music, clowns, parades and performances, all put on by local, national and international theatre companies. That sounds wonderful. So from hard bop to aerial acrobatics, I would wager that there's something for everything in Bilbao this weekend. For Monocle, in Bilbao, I'm Paul Noble.
You You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back to run through some of the summer's must-reads in just a moment.
Now, for some, the summer holidays are the chance to plough through that stack of paperbacks that's been building up on your bedside table. If you're anything like me, however, it's a last-minute thrash to remember what I vow to read, and then an ultimately unsatisfying trawl of the airport departure lounge. I have much to learn.
Getting the right book to read poolside is an art in itself, and so to help us navigate all the shelves of independent bookshops nearby, we welcome Jasper Rees, literary critic for the Arts Desk website. Hello, Jasper.
Hi there.
There's something kind of bittersweet about choosing your book for a summer holiday. You know, there's the worry that you're just not going to get the best, but the pleasure that you know you have treats in store.
There's also the anxiety that you feel that you should be using this downtime to read the incredibly weighty and important tome that you've had set aside for years, or you just want to show yourself a good time. So you have to pick between those two, don't you?
It is one of those terrible things that I always find that it's like the Booker Prize in my world. It's like, yeah, I have my long list, I have my short list, and then I have what I can get in the case.
Yeah.
And I know people who have, and I kind of agree with them, they have a 200-page limit to their books, which immediately focuses your mind, because they have to be very, very good pages. It's obviously going to cut out an awful lot of very worthy literature. But once you do that, you suddenly focus.
I'm different. I get the longer ones for my summer holidays because I know the little ones, slim ones, I can read in my working
life. You surely need to mix and match. But I think getting a 200-page, a whole stack of 200-page books makes you feel like you're working through the titles very quickly. So I think that's a very shrewd
idea. Instant gratification.
Yeah.
It is one of those things that you also have different times of the day where you require different kinds of you want to satisfy a different reading itch. The embarkation of a nice long novel in an afternoon is great fun. But then I don't know if anybody else says this, says that I must finish this book before bedtime, and at 2 o'clock in the morning and possibly a couple of glasses of wine, you're just turning the pages as quickly as you can to find out what happened.
That's a good test of a book, if it's good enough for you to want to turn the pages before you go to sleep, or if it keeps you awake.
But then, of course, there's also matching the location and the destination with the book and the subject, which brings me to your first choice.
This first choice is Italian Ways by Tim Parks. There are many, many books about Italy, but no one writes in the English language about Italy better than Tim Parks. He's lived in northern Italy for 32 years. And this is his fourth non-fiction book about Italy. He's also written novels that are based there. The first one was called Italian Neighbours, was about arriving there and learning to live there. The next one was Italian Education, about bringing up children in Italy. And then he did a book called A Season with Verona, which was about supporting his local football team. And this one, like all the other books, is a wonderful prism through which to think about Italy anthropologically. And that's what he does in Italian Ways, via the railways, via travelling by train in Italy. And it sounds like a rather a narrow idea, but it contains multitudes, this book. It's a love letter to Italy on the one hand, but also he's able to ironise Italy and the Italians like no one else. It's a fantastic read.
It is a wonderful read. It's one of those books, though, that you don't necessarily need to begin to read from start to finish. You can pick and choose, which is so satisfying.
You can
sometimes
pick and choose, but I find with all of his books, and this is no different, that once you pick it up, you don't want to put it down. Because he writes so brilliantly and so astutely, and it's just incredibly Moorish.
I sometimes hover over books and avoid them when they're written by Brits and they're about places they've adopted and they live, because I think sometimes it can fall into clichés and caricatures.
That's very much the trap of the genre, but it's one that he gives a very wide berth to. I mean, he knows the place too well to romanticise it. He understands that Italians are an extremely complex people. You know, when you go to Italy and you see it from the outside, it looks like this kind of fantasy land, but not when you have to catch a train from Verona to Milan every week and at the start of every season try and buy a season ticket and navigate the incredibly complex labyrinthine byways just to get a ticket And I should say that structurally, it's quite interesting, this book. It's the first part of the book is really set in northern Italy, and it's about his commute between those two cities I've mentioned. In the next third, he talks about the new high-speed trains, which are turning Italy into this kind of two-tier state, divided between the haves and the have-nots. And then in the last third, he embarks on a much more formal travel writing project to go and explore the south by train. And they're all very different, each section of this book. But the stuff about going down to Italy and meeting these wonderfully self-pitying Sicilians who all describe Sicily as abbandonata is just fantastic. I cannot recommend this book highly enough.
There's something that he balances quite deftly as well, which is the idea that, as you say, he's been living there for decades, he works there, he commutes, he's part of the infrastructure, yet everybody still sees him as an outsider. There's this wonderful argument he has with a municipal official from Verona who says, "Are you visitors to Italy?" And he just has to say, "I'm really sorry. I know your system." Mm. And yet at the same time, he gets embraced by the people who sell him his cheese toasty every morning. He has a real outsider's love for something that he's actually really, really close to. It's a lovely balance.
But the sense of being an outsider, the reason why he loves all that stuff is because it makes him feel embedded. It makes him feel part of the place. But there's a wonderful running joke going all the way through the book that even before, sometimes even before he's opened his mouth, people have sort of identified him as an Englishman. And he finds this intensely annoying. But there's one moment where his Englishness really comes out, where he completely loses it with a ticket inspector on the train. And it's very, very funny. And unlike all of the Italians who are surrounding him, regard this as just a wonderful everyday drama, he feels deep shame with himself afterwards, which he says is a very un-Italian thing to do.
You talk about it being social anthropology, but it also is, in a way, a kind of history of Italy, in that there's... Italy's always had a very strong relationship with railways, and whether it's Mussolini and rail tracks. Mm. So there's something more. It's not just funny little anecdotes.
Oh, absolutely. It's an extremely well-researched book. It talks about the creation of the railways I'd love to give it a precise date, but I would say around about the 1860s. And the Ferrovie dello Stato are very much, a state institution. And he understands the history of the railways all the way from the beginning right through to now. And so, yeah, it is a kind of history of Italy as seen through those two tracks, parallel tracks which carry Italians all over the peninsula.
It's what I would like to ask you there about, Jasper, about this being a holiday choice. Is this a good book to take on holiday, seeing as it is about travel and a certain place?
It's not. Yes, I would. Yeah, I mean,
because if I'm sitting on a little island off Stockholm,
yeah, and yes,
it's, little cold, little bit cold, raining, and
well, it'll
I'm
make
dreaming,
you feel warm, Emma. apart from anything else,
and it's angry with my location.
I've taken another book of his on holiday once. I took it to I took Italian education to the Bahamas years and years ago, and I thought this is a category error taking this book, but just because it's so good, it didn't matter at all.
People often want escapism, and with escapism often becomes celebrity biographies. What's your second choice?
Well, I wanted to talk about this. I'm not necessarily sure that this is a book for everyone.
It's certainly not for me, because it's thick
and hardback.
Okay, and it's in, well, you can read it on an e-reader. So that's this whole thing about hardbacks is no longer an issue, is it? This is an authorised biography of Oliver Reed, called What Fresh Lunacy Is This?, which I have to say I think is a terrible title.
Yeah.
Partly because there's a great deal of lunacy in the book and quite a lot of it is not very fresh. Oliver Reed, as we know, was the great British screen hero who sadly in the end never was, because he drank his career away. And this is the story about how he did it. Even though it's an authorised biography, it's an extremely frank account of what went wrong. He would turn up on set and instantly cause chaos. He would always work hard on set, do all his scenes and everything, and then they would call cut on the end of the day, and he would start drinking.
That's so self-destructive.
And on the eighth drink, you know, he was a sort of, I don't know, a kind of Falstaffian type of Lord of Misrule or something until the eighth drink, and then things started to turn nasty. And, you know, the furniture started to fly and people ended up in hospital.
And this is what what the lasting impression of this book appears to be. It is a story of Oliver Reed and his drinking as opposed to Oliver Reed and his films.
Well, no, there's a great deal about his career. I mean, the career, sadly, the career which could have had a great renaissance had he not died on the set of the biggest film he'd ever worked on, which was Gladiator. That certainly would have established him as one of the great British screen presences, which he undoubtedly was, extremely attractive and charismatic on screen. And he was a great actor. He understood the proper skill of screen acting, which is you do as little as possible. And his uncle, Carol Reed, who directed him in Oliver, was the one who said to him, "Whisper."
Did he love acting there?
He actually didn't particularly. He didn't like actors either. He hung out with his mates, whose friendship he was able to buy by buying them rounds and rounds and rounds of drinks. I think he regarded it as a way of just making money and fueling his fun.
How satisfying a book is this? It has everybody talking in it. It's incredibly anecdotal, which, I mean, obviously you get with a biography.
It is.
But it's ferociously anecdotal.
But watching, what's satisfying about it is watching, it, grimly satisfying, is watching the inevitable fall. Unfortunately, the stories are a little bit too monotonously the same, because every drinking binge is like every other drinking binge. And in a way, alcoholics aren't great company. It's a very sad book in a way, because he, although the author Robert Sellers doesn't really pin it down, he clearly was suffering from a deficit of parental love, and you know, his parents split up when he was small. His mother was very fond of GIs, and his father never hugged him. So and he was dyslexic as well. So in the era when dyslexia, if you were dyslexic, you were just called a dunce. So he did all this stuff as a way of compensating for a. A lack in his life.
We have a couple of minutes remain to talk about Eugen Ruger in Times of Fading Light, a novel which has been published to tremendous acclaim.
It has been published to tremendous acclaim, and I'm going to half contribute to that acclaim by saying that I'm halfway through it and I'm loving it. It's obviously a German novel. It's set in East Germany from just after the end of the war until after the fall of the Berlin Wall. It's a subtly compelling family saga, and I'd love to tell you what happens at the end, but I don't actually know yet. But I can't
novelist.
Wait.
First time novelist, yes.
Yeah. Can I talk about some other books which I've been reading this year? All of them. Well worth recommending and buying for your e-readers for the summer, or some of them are quite slender volumes, so you can actually pick them up and read them on your sun lounger. The first one is, there are two memoirs, just very quickly. Al Alvarez, the great poet and critic, has written a book called Pond Life, and it's about the dying of the light, of going swimming in Hampstead Ponds in North London, and it's about getting very, very old and trying to fend off the Grim Reaper. And it sounds like it's a grim read, but it's not. It's extremely uplifting. There's a book by Rupert Christiansen, another memoir, this time about childhood. He was abandoned by his father, who just walked out when he was a child. And this book is called I Know You're Going to Be Happy. It's a very slim read. It's extremely compelling, though, well worth reading. Can I mention another celebrity biog?
If you've got about 10 seconds.
Rod, the autobiography. It doesn't sound like it's going to be a cracking read. It really is.
It is. We've read it. We've reviewed it before on the review.
Right.
And it satisfies that test of when you open a page randomly and read out a line.
It's brilliantly ghosted.
Everything is great. Jasper Rees, thank you very much indeed joining us here on The Review. All those books are out now, ready to be read under a tree in the sun somewhere. That brings us to the end of the Saturday Review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our thanks to our producer, Katie Bilboa, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Annabelle Bly. Our researcher was Anton Fredriksson. Our studio manager was Claire Urban.
We're handing back over to Georgina with Weekend Edition next, where you can catch our pick of the weekend's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time with Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
In the meantime, though, you've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson.
And Gillian Tobias. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.